Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Kiana Mickey, a member of the Civil Society Mechanism Coordinating Committee, who speaks with Mark Dunley about corporate agribusiness domination and a need to hear from the voices of peasants, farmers, food, and agriculture workers. Then on Reclaiming History, Livonia brings us part five, her favorite part, of her interview with Egyptologist Dr. Solange Ashby, the author of Calling Out to ISIS. After that, WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry brings us his new segment entitled Solidarity Notes, in which he will discuss various labor articles in the August issue of Solidarity Notes with Tom Ellis, writer and member of the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District. Then, on Crown, Yolissa Richardson speaks with legendary activist Dr. Alice Reen about her feelings on the justice system, including re-enslavement of minority groups and the danger of police officers responding to mental health crises. And to close out the show, Uptown Summer Radio program mentors Sina Vizilahicki and Jody Cowan bring us part two of their roundtable conversation with Uptown Summer youth about their relationships with radio. But first, here are the headlines. The State University of New York is finalizing a plan to grant widespread relief for outstanding tuition and fees incurred by students during the pandemic. A $1 trillion infrastructure bill moved through the U.S. Senate on Thursday amid bipartisan support in a deal that lawmakers said would help keep billions of dollars to New York for bridge repairs and improvements to airports and water and sewer systems. The deal includes $28.6 million for Albany International Airport. Nearly 4 months after the state agreed to spend $15 million directly to address vaccine hesitancy, Governor Andrew Cuomo finalized deals with organizations working within communities where cases of COVID-19 are skyrocketing because of relatively low vaccination rates. The Biden administration announced Thursday it will allow a nationwide ban on evictions to expire Saturday, arguing that its hands are tied after the Supreme Court signaled the moratorium would only be extended until the end of the month. People with disabilities and their advocates gathered Thursday in Schenectady to press for more state funding for the caregivers who work with the disabled. The money is part of the Medicare funding stream and has not seen a net increase in a decade. And our last headline comes from Public News Service.
Over 10,000 New York and New Jersey frontline airport workers will get health insurance as part of new contract negotiations that come at a time when more people are flying. The Healthy Terminals Act provides zero premium cost health coverage to contract workers at John F. Kennedy, LaGuardia, and Newark Liberty International Airports. According to the labor union SEIU 32BJ, it's the first state-level legislation of its kind in the country. Rob Hill, union vice president and New York and New Jersey Airports division director, says it's a victory that they're finally being recognized as essential workers, but it comes at a price.
And, you know, unfortunately, we lost some of our members due to the pandemic and the virus. To get the public to see that and the airlines and state that these workers have to have health care.
COVID-19 has disproportionately affected people of color, in part because many are frontline workers. Hill sees the addition of health insurance as a racial justice matter, and since contract airport workers are predominantly people of color, he thinks similar measures should be in place at other U.S. airports. Especially with new variants of COVID-19 spreading, Hill says workers having health care benefits is in the public interest.
That concern is also why this is an issue not just for the workers, but for the traveling public to know that the airport workers are coming in contact with, have the ability to go to the doctor and take care of themselves and have sick days, etc.
The contract includes quarterly reviews to ensure compliance with health and safety guidance, along with policies requiring PPE, social distancing, and other precautions. Also included are new policies to protect workers from discrimination for natural hair or hairstyles tied to racial, ethnic, or cultural identities. I'm Michaela Savitt reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And that's it for the headlines. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear? Find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390, that's 518-272-2390. Civil society and Indigenous peoples organizations have launched a global counter-mobilization against the UN Food Systems Summit. Kiana Mickey, a member of the Civil Society Mechanism Coordinating Committee, discusses the concern about corporate agribusiness domination and the need to hear from the voices of peasants, farmers, food and agriculture workers, consumers, and others. With Mark Dudley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Over 300 global civil society organizations of small-scale food producers, researchers, and Indigenous people held a recent online summit to protest against the United Nations Food Systems pre-summit. The People's Counter-Mobilization to Transform Corporate Food System is the latest in a series of rejections of the UN Food Systems Summit, which critics argue is disproportionately influenced by corporate actors. We're joined by Kiana Mickey, who is a member of the Civil Society Mechanism Coordinating Committee. You know, what is the UN Food Systems and why has the Civil Society Mechanism come together to offer counter to it?
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah. So a little context to the UN Food Systems Summit. So it is it's a multi-day meeting that is supposed to bring together thought leaders, policymakers, farmers, and other concerted stakeholders to really kind of talk about how we should be transforming our world food production. How do we think about food and lift up and amplify solutions? And so there's like different tracks that bring along these different players from all different realms like science, business, and policy and academia, as well as supposedly youth organizations and farmers. So that's like what the summit is. And it's going to be held, we had a pre-summit in Rome and the full summit will happen in September at the United Nations in New York City. But what we've been seeing over the last couple of months or even longer than that is this continued pushing out of the grassroots voice, the pushing out of small farmer stakeholders, and the increase of corporate capture within a summit that's really supposed to be about all of our food systems. So the UN Food Summit is really kind of in this critical pivot of saying that they're really trying to work towards amplifying solutions, but actually taking most of the people out that are really trying to move our food systems to a more resilient place.
Now, while the, you know, sort of corporate agribusiness food production system is often touted as, oh, it does a much better job of feeding people and growing food, in reality, it's almost the opposite case that yes, it contributes both to hunger and malnutrition, and it's actually the small scale food systems that actually produce more food to feed people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think none of us have to look any, you know, too far to see the result of a global food system or what happens when we, you know, continue to prioritize corporate scale. You know, we can look at the fires, you know, that are burning throughout our world. We can look to droughts. We can look to famine. We can look to food insecurity. For example, like over, you know, 118 million more people were facing hunger in 2020 than before. So if this is a system that's working, why isn't it not working? And what we do know is that when we look at regional food systems, when we look at local food systems, when we support, you know, agroecology, when we support food sovereignty, self-determination of resilient growing practices, resilient models that support small to mid-scale farmers in order to connect to communities in need and building a multiplier effect of not just economy, but healthy food, we see the difference. We see the impact and why those solutions are seen as outliers versus the answers and the way forward It's beyond me. And that's really what we were lifting up at our counter mobilization, is really trying to find a way to amplify the voices and work of small stakeholder farmers from across the globe, and that there are resilient solutions in our grasp. We need to resource those and we need to support those.
I was just reading a press release the organization sent out, and it made the point about a third of the people on the planet, lack access to an adequate, food supply. Why has the United Nations been so captured by the corporate agribusiness, and what needs to happen to sort of elevate the voices of the sustainable small indigenous farmers, community farmers?
I mean, from my perspective, being somebody who works on the ground and has been active in civil society work and other global grassroots movements, I see this leaning into corporate capture, just like we see in other parts of our food systems. I think it's a desire to continue to center capitalism as our only solution for our political and economic solution to our food crisis. And I don't think that's the case. But I think that it's this desire to continue to find ways to amplify problematic profit, how to amplify, corporate and industrial agriculture as a solution, as opposed to more, resilient measures. And I think that's something we see widespread throughout our food systems, local, regional, as well as international.
15, 20 years ago, I was very active, particularly in New York State, trying to stop genetic engineering of our food system. And so when I was an expert on this 15, 20 years ago, United States was really the ground zero for this, unprecedented experiment. How has that GMO issue, developed over the last 15, 20 years? And my unfortunate guess would be that many, many more countries are now seeing GMOs as a increasingly dominant part of their food system.
I would say you're kind of hitting it on the head in the sense of, oftentimes the U.S. is seen as like a leader in a lot of systems and even in our agriculture space. So then we, but again, if this is the top of it, if what we're hearing is like divest from, don't address inequalities in our food system, don't address exploitation or extraction of natural resources, and just lean into more of these tech or innovations, or it's framed as like these are the answers or solutions, then people are going to follow. And also people follow the money as well. So people follow the power and the money. But what we really need to continue to hear and see are the voices of not just the grassroots in America, in the US, but also the voices of leaders in the global South. And I think we need to see more of that. And I think what we, within our counter mobilizations try to do really well is prioritize indigenous voices, prioritize voices of color, like resilient practices, resilient ways of connecting smallholder farmers, fishermen, pastoralists, and rural workers. And this should really be the voice in the center, the most impacted should be the driving force and decision makers of our food systems, not the other way around. So when it comes to GMOs, I think we also need to continue to push on what is seen as a prevailing voice, or our technology that comes out of the US and also connect to the voices on the ground here as well, and biodiversity, social, economic, and climate justice leaders.
So we've been talking with Kiana Mickey, a member of the Civil Society Mechanism Coordinating Committee, about the UN food system. In the last moment, Kiana, so can you quickly articulate, what are some of the alternatives your group hopes to be pushing, and how can people find out more information and have some impact?
Yes. So I encourage folks to continue to follow our hashtag, which is food systems for the number four people, and continue to follow up on our website, foodsystemsforpeople.org. So the four is a number, not. I would continue to encourage folks to start looking into if food sovereignty sounds something new to them, continue to look into that. If agroecology sounds new, continue to look out for the work of the civil society mechanism. Because right now we had this great counter mobilization against corporate capture, but this is just one stop on a long road. Between now and September, there will be more information to be found. And we'll be doing more interventions with the UN summit coming to New York.
Anna Mickey, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was HMN's Mark Dunley speaking with Kiana Mickey of the Civil Society Mechanism Coordinating Committee. Next on Reclaiming History, we have part 5 of Livonia's conversation with Dr. Solange Ashby. Dr. Ashby discusses Queen Amonarena Skandraki, the queen that defeated Roman Emperor Augustus as he attempted to invade, annex, and levy heavy taxes on the Nubians of the Mariotic Empire or the Kush. Livonia has informed us that this was her favorite segment of the series.
Do you know anything about the Candace queen that defeated Augustus?
It's quite likely that it was Amonarena. If you look at the images, if you just Google Meroitic queen, Kushite queen, you'll see images of very voluptuous, statuesque, thick, if you will, women.
So she was a brick house, in other words.
Yes, you know, I laugh because I keep waiting to work up the urge to play the Commodore's brick house when I give a lecture about these Meroitic.
The excerpts you just heard are from my upcoming continuing series of interviews with Dr. Solange Ashby, the first Black female Egyptologist in 221 years of the discipline. Stay tuned.
Doc, do you know anything about the Candace queen that defeated Augustus?
Yes, so it's not 100% sure which of these 5 amazing queens who ruled basically back to back in the first century before Christ and the first century after the birth of Christ. But it's quite likely that it was Amonarena. She is likely the one who is referred to in Acts of the Apostles from the New Testament as the Queen Candace. And that was, you know, the New Testament was originally written in Greek. So this is Greek writers trying to render the Meroitic title Kandake into their language. And so we get Candace. And so for any of our listeners, if that's your name or the name of anyone you know, it's a very prestigious name with long history from the kingdom of Meroe.
And so she defeats Augustus in a military campaign.
They go head to head a couple of times, I think 29 before Christ, and then again around 21 before Christ. There are military conflicts as the Romans, Augustus's troops, are trying to push south into Nubia. They had just conquered Egypt upon the suicide of Cleopatra the VII, and so they try to continue going south, and this amazing warrior queen meets them in battle just south of the Dodekaskoino, so just south of that lower Nubia area that we've been talking about. And it's more like a stalemate, at least this is how Augustus tells us, right? And we have yet to be able to read the Meroitic script, the texts that tell us about this battle. But suffice it to say that the Romans didn't end up going any further south than this site called Kasr Ibrim, that they stopped trying to impose taxes, oppressive taxes on the Meroitic people. And in fact, they started paying the kingdom of Meroe essentially to say, all right, no more attacking into Egypt here. We're paying you to stay south of this border. So clearly she was very successful in her battle against the Romans.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to another segment of Reclaiming History with Dr. Solange Ashby, PhD, Egyptologist, Nubiologist, And we're talking about her new book, Calling Out to ISIS, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae, published by Gorgias Press.
That's G-O-R-G-I-A-S Press.com.
So geographically, where would this imaginary line be on a map based on today's geography where the Romans actually stopped their assault into Nubia?
The town, the city that is sort of the southern border of Roman-Egyptian controlled Nubia is called Maharaka, and that is still in today in modern day Egypt. Its southern border is at probably at the second cataract, which is just an area of the Nile that has rapids in it. But if anyone's traveled to Abu Simbel, that amazing temple of Ramses the Great far south in Nubia, it's still north of that. So somewhere north of the Sudanese border.
So is it true that she was a one-eyed queen?
That's what Strabo tells us, the historian who wrote in Greek, right? And I like to imagine... that she was a warrior queen. And unlike Augustus, who was sending his generals into battle, she had her generals, but she also was leading the charge. And I like to imagine that she was one-eyed because she probably was injured in battle. He also calls her mannish, which for a Roman is the ultimate insult. But if you look at the images, if you just Google Meroitic queen, Kushite queen, you'll see images of very voluptuous, statuesque, thick, if you will, women. And so that was considered beautiful and a sign of power. And Meroites were really okay with powerful women. But for the Romans, they were really terribly misogynistic, and that was something that was just horrifying to them, that there would not only be a sole ruling queen and she would be leading her troops into battle, but that she was proudly a big, thick woman and very curvaceous.
So she was a brick house, in other words.
Yes, she was. You know, I laugh because I keep waiting to work up the urge to play the Commodore's Brick House when I give a lecture about these Meroitic queens. Yes, she was.
And just the fact of her fighting and leading her army engenders fear in the in the hearts of men, right?
Yeah. Yes.
In the hearts of men that they go running. Because here she comes, this brick house, and she is fighting mad. And unlike the story that we hear, everyone knows the story of Cleopatra, how she used an asp to poison, you know, to bite herself, and she dies suicidal. Mm-hmm. No, instead, he runs into this queen in southern Egypt, and she says, bring it.
Yes.
Bring it.
The Romans were already freaked out by Cleopatra. She was just too much of a wild woman for them. So you'd know they lost it when they ran into a Minoaneus.
It was the true origins of misogynoir, right?
Yes.
Historically. So listen, Dr. Solange Aspe, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show talking about your book, Calling Out to ISIS, The Enduring Nubian Presence at Philae. Dr. Ashby, is there anything else that you want our listeners to know about your work or anything new that you're getting ready to start?
Yes. I'm really pleased to say that I've been awarded a President's Postdoc Fellowship at UCLA. And so this is going to allow me to really read, research, and write for a year or two. And I will be publishing a second book specifically about these Kushite queens and Nubian women in particular. And then when I'm done with that postdoc, I will start teaching at UCLA. I'll start a tenure track position there. And my goal really and I'm just going to keep speaking it into existence, is to establish the first ever doctoral program in Nubiology, because at this point, sadly, there's not one in the entire world, but look for one sometime in the next few years at UCLA.
Dr. Shalange Ashby, you are a value to the field of Egyptology. You are a value to the field of studying African cultures. We are so honored that you agreed to be on this segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Livonia Mallory with Egyptologist Dr. Shalange Ashby. You just heard part five of a multi-part segment. You can find the rest online at mediasanctuary.org. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany. Coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry started a new segment entitled Solidarity Notes. In this segment, he'll discuss various labor articles in the August issue of Solidarity Notes with Tom Ellis, writer and member of the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District. Solidarity Notes segment will air on the third or fourth Thursday each month. You're about to hear part two of a multi-part segment.
And again, this is Willie Terry, a roaming labor correspondent, and I'm talking to Tom Ellis, who is a member of Capital District Solidarity Committee, and we're discussing the newsletter that they put out called Solidarity Notes. And we're going over certain news articles in the Solidarity Notes, and Tom Ellis is breaking this information down for us. Now, Tom, there's another article in there. The New York State AFL-CIO called out HBO for violating workers' rights in Troy. I know in Troy, we had a movie company over here recently, and the name, and there was the Guild. They did a minister series called The Gilded Age. Something quite unique that happened in Troy, and a lot of people was glad that they came. But I didn't know that there was labor trouble going on with that. The 23 orchestra musicians who were not in the union.
Right, they were denied permission for union representation.
Mm-hmm.
Even more troubling is the fact that when the musicians asked to be represented by the American Federation of Musicians, AFM, Homebox office fired them. For many of these musicians, this is their first opportunity to return to work after more than a year of being without work due to the pandemic. This is a blatant violation of federal labor law and a shameful disregard for workers' rights, according to Mario Salento.
Mm-hmm. And he's president of the New York State AFL-CIO, Mario Salento.
That's correct.
Well, mm-hmm. Well, that means that, well, you know, looking at this in the future, wherever the Hollywood come to our area, the unions might have to get involved in discussion, especially, you know, if there's labor problems. So, Tom, I'm moving on to another article I see here called The Hidden Hand of the U.S. Blockade Spark Cuba Protest. And that's something that I think went on just as recently as this weekend in terms of people who were protesting the blockade against Cuba by America.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a local group called Albany Cuba Solidarity, which has been organizing a caravan on, I think, one Sunday a month for the better part of a year now, I think. And they've been trying to draw attention that the United States maintains an economic embargo against Cuba and pressure shipping companies to participate in it. And this has been in existence since 1960. Trump intensified it when he was president. And I think Biden has intensified it even more. Mm-hmm. Biden is like an old-fashioned cold warrior, calling Cuba a failed state, which is, I think, a very false statement. You know, the embargo prevents Cubans from getting medicines and medical equipment and farming equipment and many other things. And what the effect of it is that it has kept Cuba from becoming a much wealthier and more successful country than it would have been had there been no embargo.
Right.
And I think that's the goal of the United States, mm-hmm. is to keep Cuba a poor country so that the United States can say, see, socialism doesn't work, communism doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Why would anybody want to be like them? Mm-hmm. I think the threat that Cuba presents to the United States is certainly not a military threat in any way. Mm-hmm. But what they do is they serve, their government serves as a role model for other countries, especially in Latin America. So the leaders of Cuba can say to, like, the leaders of Haiti or to the Dominican Republic or to even the big countries like Mexico and Brazil, you know, we don't do what the United States tells us to do, and you shouldn't be being pushed around by the United States either. You know, we can survive, and you should too. So I think it's as a positive role model and as a successful being able to resist American domination. I think that's where Cuba has been successful. And other things is they've got, they have lower infant mortality rate than the United States. People in Cuba on average live longer than in the United States, a couple years longer. They probably have a higher literacy rate in the United than Americans do. And whereas the United States exports weapons and other things around the world, Cuba is well known for exporting its physician space. It maintains a school, a medical school, where students come from all over the world, including the United States, to get a free medical education, with the understanding that they'll go back to their home countries and work as physicians and take care of poor people, in that they're not, the goal of going to that medical school isn't to try to get some job in Europe or the United States where you can make $300,000 or $400,000 a year, mm-hmm. but more to serve the people who need, the poor people around the world who need it. And so they've been very successful with that.
Right. And I know the United States tried to get the world to do an embargo on Cuba, and I think the UN voted something like either 160 or 180 something to 2. And I think only Israel and the U.S.
Israel and the U.S. voted no.
No, on that, right. And I always wondered, Tom, why would the U.S. have such an antagonistic attitude towards Cuba when they don't have an anti-attitude like they have towards Cuba against Russia and against China? Trade with China, they trade with Russia.
Yes, well, I mean, Russia is no longer a communist country, so, mm-hmm. so some people view them as less of an adversary. And from a business perspective, they're a capitalist country. You're almost like a gangster capitalist country, mm-hmm. the way their system operates. I mean, China is they still have the Chinese Communist Party, but over the last 30 or so years, China has become very much a capitalist country in many ways. Mm-hmm. Although the Communist Party maintains a tight political dictatorship over the country, people have freedom to travel, the freedom to conduct business within certain limits. And so the United States does a tremendous amount of trading with China. And I think that American factories have moved over to China to take advantage of cheap labor. And the United States and trade and China have a lot of trade with each other. So that's part of the reason we don't hear so much criticism of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think Cuba is different. I think in Cuba you have a Communist Party which still believes in, like, communism or socialism, still mm-hmm. believes it's a good system. Mm-hmm. And I think that's problematic for the United States, because the United States would like to see the whole world become capitalists or semi-capitalist.
And let me just move on, Tom. There's another article, and you go, this is called The Growing Amazon Business Model and Threat. and that Amazon is creating some type of business model, expand their reach out other than what they're doing now?
Yeah, Amazon is constantly expanding into new businesses. I mean, I think they started out as like a book publishing, and then they got into food, and now it seems they want to get into just about everything sooner or later. And I think they used to work extensively with United Parcel Service to have UPS deliver their products to people. And now they're doing that more and more on their own, although the people who are doing the deliveries are technically, or Amazon pretends that they're not Amazon employees, that they're sort of like contractors or some nebulous in between being an employee.
And that means that they don't have to provide benefits for them, right?
Right. Yeah, well, Amazon is notorious for not providing benefits. And, you know, they've got more than 1 million employees in the United States. And they're a very powerful company. And the CEO, or the former CEO of Amazon, is worth almost $200 billion, which is a phenomenal amount of money, in my opinion. In the Congress and in the United States, we don't enforce antitrust laws. Some of these corporations are just far too large, and their executives are far too wealthy than we should ever have allowed.
And Bezos is using his $200 billion by developing him a toy and flying into outer space.
Yeah, he did, I think, about a week or two ago.
Right.
I think it was like a 10-minute flight, but it was a big publicity stunt for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, he don't... Give certain employees benefits and raises.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, there are many people like in the United States, like people who are in their 60s and 70s and they live in mobile homes, and they live maybe in the southern states during the winter, and maybe they move around maybe into the northern states during the summer. And they work at Walmarts from time to time. So these are people in their 60s and 70s, maybe even older. And, you know, many of us think that they should be able to be retired at that age, but that they're working at Amazon. Amazon's willing to hire them, but they're being worked pretty hard. And to me, that's not a desirable lifestyle, to have to sell a house or to have to give up an apartment and to be sort of like on the road all the time and not have a permanent base anymore or a permanent place of residence. So Amazon takes advantage of those people.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. That's Tom Ellis, member of the Capital District Solidarity Committee.
That was roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaking with Tom Ellis, a writer and member of the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District, on the new segment, Solidarity Notes. Up next, Yulissa Richardson brings us her interview with Dr. Alice Green on Crowned. Alice Green is a member of the board of directors of the New York State Defenders Association and a founder of the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region. For over 20 years, she's worked as a prison volunteer. During this interview, they discussed her feelings on the justice system as re-enslavement for minority groups and about police interaction with mental health crises.
Hello, my name is Yulissa Richardson, and today we are interviewing Dr. Alice Green for the Crowned and Exploration of Prison Injustice and Mental Health radio series. Will you begin with introducing yourself and your line of work, Dr. Alice Green?
Yes, my name is Alice Green. I am the executive director of the Center for Law and Justice, which is located in Albany but serves the Capital District area. We are a civil rights and human rights organization that focuses on issues around racism as well as criminal justice and inequities in that system.
In your interview with News 10 in February of 2021, you stated how the justice system is re-enslavement of the minority group. Can you further explain your meaning behind your statement?
Well, you have to understand historically what enslavement looked like. And it was an effort to use race as a factor to put people in certain positions, that we oppressed them, we stole people's labor. They were basically controlled by a white population for economic advantage and social advantage. And we've always found ways of maintaining that system of control. Even when, you know, after the Civil War and when we no longer had chattel slavery, we found ways to continue to treat people as if they were enslaved. You know, low wages, the criminal justice system stepped in with convict leasing systems where people would be basically taken off the street, incarcerated, charged with loitering or whatever charge they could come up with. And they were leased to businesses and other white people basically the same way that they were before. So we've used, and we use the criminal justice system to try to maintain that relationship between Blacks and the dominant community. Police officers, for instance, were used to help control that economic system and the people who are in it. They were the ones who unfortunately worked with groups like the Ku Klux Klan, informing people about hangings and lynchings and all of that, and, you know, helped criminalize people when during the Jim Crow era. And also we used the criminal justice system to deny people the right to vote, which is another big problem. We still do that. People with felons and incarcerated in our society cannot vote. So, you know, it's been happening ever since 1619 that we control Black people, that we use the criminal justice system to help in that control. So when I was going into prison, they barred me now, so I can't go back in. But when I was going into prison, hits you if you don't realize it. The minute you walk through the door, you will see that all the people who are behind the bars are Black, and all the people, mainly most of the people, particularly like in the Adirondacks and northern part of the country, correction officers tend to be white. And it that whole system looks a whole lot like it did during, you know, the period from 1619 on, when we were enslaved. You still have white people controlling Black people in this country. And it's still there. So when I go to a prison, it looks a lot like a plantation where, you know, you're controlled by white people. You don't get paid for your labor. Sometimes they give you a few cents, but, you know, they can get labor out of you and you're not paid for it. And you are demeaned. Black people are thought of as inferior. So that's the same thing it was during the period of enslavement. So I don't see a whole lot of difference. As a matter of fact, when I'm in the Adirondack, I found out that 70% African Americans, according to the census data, 70% of them are African American. And if you look at that, you think that there are African Americans running free in the Adirondacks. But they're not. 70% of the people, of the African-American people in the Adirondacks, are incarcerated. We take people from their families and we put them in these facilities where they are controlled. That's the same thing we did during enslavement. We separated individuals from their families. We stole their labor. We controlled them by white people. We used a correctional system, the police system, to criminalize, also to deny them the right to vote. So it looks a whole lot like, I mean, I could spend all day telling you about how the two systems look exactly the same to me. They're very close.
Also in this interview, you briefly touched on the name of Jesse Davis. For our listening audience, will you share who Jesse Davis was and how his death sparked you to want change within your community?
Yes, 1984, Jesse Davis was a mental health patient. The police department knew that he had mental health problems. They knew it because they'd been called out because sometimes Jesse got loud on the street. So everybody in the police department knew that Jesse Davis had some mental health issues. But on this one day, July 8, 1984, the police responded to a call from someone that Jesse was making noise again. So several police officers went to the scene, but Jesse had, you know, gone back into his apartment. They went to his apartment, knocked on the door, and told Jesse to come out. And Jesse did not do that. He wasn't breaking a law. He was simply in his apartment. But they went around and got on the roof and looked through the window and saw Jesse. And they, you know, I can't explain it, but what they did was they shot Jesse Davis, shot him in the head, and he was lying there dying. When another police officer had been called to the scene, he took a photograph of what had happened, of Jesse lying on his floor. So the whole case went through the criminal justice system. The district attorney's office said that they certainly were given cause to shoot Jesse because he approached them with a knife and a fork. And it took a while for us to locate it, but there was a photo. The photo that was taken was hidden in the police department files. And we took a look at it. I still have that photo. Jesse was lying there dying. And what he had in his hand was a toy truck and keychain. No knife, no fork. So they murdered Jesse and they got away with it. This was, you know, something that I had difficulty dealing with. And it moved me to say, we got to do something. Of course, we did do something in the community and we brought it to the community's attention. We did demonstrations. We did everything. We filed a lawsuit. I worked on that case for 10 years. It didn't really get resolved. I wish we could have gone to court so that the rest of the community could know what these police officers did to Jesse. It took us 10 years to, you know, resolve the case in the courts. And before that, the city had offered Jesse's family $12,500 for murdering Jesse. And we suggested that they not take it. So we were prepared to go to court, and they end up getting, at least at this particular time, it's probably more money than we think of it now, but they got $500,000. But that didn't resolve the issue. We said we have to do something, particularly for people who have mental health issues and they come in contact with the police department. So we were able to get the city and the county to establish a mobile crisis unit that would be called out when there were suspected mental health issues of a particular individual. So that, you know, that's one change. But since then, we decided that we really needed to do closer monitoring of the police department, and especially how they dealt with mental health issues and other health issues. So the center got formed to do that kind of monitoring and also to work for changes in policies and approaches to dealing with people in the community. So that's what we've been doing for 36 years, is building up an organization which has become basically an institution in the community that deals with issues around crime, criminal justice, policing, and the criminal justice system, and the racism that we see that's a part of the entire system.
That was Yolissa Richardson speaking with activist Dr. Alice Green on Crown. The 2021 Uptown Summer Youth Program started July 6th at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Radio program mentors Sina Bazila-Hickey and Jody Cowan hosted a roundtable meeting with the incoming group as they discussed their relationships with radio. This is part two of two.
On July 6, 2021, the Media Sanctuary welcomed its Uptown Summer Youth Program for a month of workshops in its learning facilities in Troy, New York. Producer Sina Bazila-Hickey and myself interviewed the incoming group as they introduced themselves on the first day.
My name is Remus, and I have been a participant in this.
Hi, my name is Jada.
Hi, my name is Genesis.
Hi, I'm Octavian.
Oh, my bad. What's good? My name's Natalia, a.k.a. Mr. Pickles.
Hi, I'm Branda Miller, and I'm the Arts and Education Coordinator at the Sanctuary, and I'm really excited to be with these amazing, brilliant Uptown Summer Youth 2021. Yeah!
Jumping back into the conversation from our Part 1 segment, the group was in discussion about their relationship to radio, feelings toward the messages they heard, and possible ways things could be improved.
Like, growing up now, it's, like, very demotivating because all you hear is, like, bad stuff about children and what they're doing. But, like, there's good stuff going on. And then, like, so, like, whatever you're telling your children or you're giving them or just letting them watch, it's going to affect them in the long run.
I do agree with you on the fact that it is very demotivating to live, because I mean, I of course understand your point of view. Like, all we hear for like Black youth is like kid gets killed, or like thief, or like assault, or like this happened, or this guy got killed, or like some sort of like cliche. But I mean, I'm not trying to put you down or anything, but for like, I don't hear anything from natives, because I mean, as a native myself, it's like very disheartening that like the only like publication that we have ever gotten like so far, like right now, is, oh yeah, we found dead children, 250 of them, right, in a school, in an unmarked mass grave. Yeah, let's just confirm that they're dead. Like, that's all like the publication that I've heard from like native voices is, like, it's not even from native voices, it's just like other people like looking in. It's like,
the thing is with like news on the radio or even on TV, it's like, it gets aggravating because you hear about all of these different things, but there's like no one talking about a solution. And so another thing is like, you constantly hear these bad things about your different groups and demographics that you are a part of, but you never hear anything positive. And like when I was listening, I was just thinking, like, what if we had like a positive news radio station or a positive news channel, like on TV or even, yeah, like on the radio, just for us to hear positive news about different groups that we're a part of that includes everybody. Because it's like, it gets aggravating hearing the same things. Like, especially like when you're a person of color, because you hear the same things over and over again. Like, it would be nice to have a positive radio station talking about the different organizations that help prevent these issues. Like there's a lot of them in Troy. Maybe bring more attention to the organizations or movements that are doing things positive.
That's why our moms and fathers are very, very hard on us the way we are. Because if we go outside with us and we are Black already and we're acting like a fool, we're going to get stereotyped and it's going to revolve to our parents. Like, we can't do certain stuff, and our parents will tell us certain stuff and they'll pull us to the side and I'm like, you can't do that. You're a Black male. You cannot go outside dressed like that with your hood on. You're a Black male. You can get shot.
Right.
Like, there's certain things I cannot do late night that you, I'm not saying doing anything, but you could go outside and do, and anything you want, anything will happen to you. Like,
no,
it's different.
I definitely get that.
And so, like, I think what the main problem is that the media controls that. And so, like, what we were saying, some people don't listen to radio because there's all these different things poured onto us. But if we have the aux, if we have our CDs, we have control. If we don't want to listen to something that's on the radio, we can tune it out with our own music or our own podcast or whatever we want to listen to, without hearing the things that the mass majority has to hear. Because I'm not the mass majority, I'm just me.
So what about the idea of the radio? What kind of stories would you like to hear on the radio?
More so like situations and problems that are happening now, instead of, you know, being stuck on one thing that's been happening. I think we should start talking about more issues and problems that are going on nowadays.
How did it feel having this discussion? Do you want to continue?
I want to say that this discussion here, this was very educational. This discussion was very educational. And like, come on, I'm 14. You guys are like 28, 27.
I'm 15.
Come on, like, you guys are supposed to be like,
I feel old.
You should be having, like, y'all should know this already.
What I liked about talking with you guys today is, like, I'm more comfortable now, because I was talking with Angelo to you guys, and like, I feel like I didn't have much of a connection, but like, hearing you guys' opinions now, and like more of like what you guys stand for and like what you're passionate about, it kind of deepens the connection that we have, I guess. I still just met you, but it's like I still connect with all of you on so many levels.
Personally, for me, the best part about having this conversation
with everyone. I mean, like, not to insult the people that are probably gonna like understand when I say it in this room, but my favorite part about this conversation was it wasn't white people talking about it and bringing it up. It was like legitimate like POC people talking about POC issues. Sorry. Like, I agree with you. I did find like a better connection because it wasn't someone from the outside trying to put themselves in here. It was like people who like genuinely understood during this conversation, and I really do like that.
I just feel like it was a great conversation to be able to hear everyone's opinions on different things, and I feel like it's something that we could all like grow on and work on, like every day talk about a different topic and, you know, hear more opinions on different things. So it was a great talk.
It was interesting to listen and hear about all the things that, you know, I can't really understand properly, but get a different perspective.
We all, in a way, have been oppressed growing up in a world of systemic racism, you know? So, I think it's really important for you to be here as who you are and not other people. So I just want to thank you and tell you I appreciate you.
The Uptown Summer Youth Program is a 5-week leadership program that pairs youth side by side with community leaders, media professionals, college interns, scientists, and artists, all in an effort to amplify youth voices in Rensselaer County. More info can be found at themediasanctuary.org/projects/UptownSummer2001. For the Media Sanctuary and Hudson Mohawk Magazine, this has been Jody Cowan.
You just heard the radio roundtable conversation with Uptown Summer Youth Program members about their relationship with radio. Learn more about the Uptown Summer Program on our website, where we have photos and recaps of our workshops. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight is Sina Biziolahecki. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org/stories. That's mediasanctuary.org/stories, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.